there any questions on last time or the stuff we've been doing earlier this week?
I have several questions.
Okay.
I have two questions. One which pertains to last time ownership.
Mm-hmm.
First, I want to know, how many qubits do you need to do serious cryptographic damage?
Right. Okay. So that's actually a more subtle question to answer than one might realize. So, you know, actually, I'm going to defer that question to later on in the course, because next week we're going to be talking about algorithms, and so we'll discuss Shor's algorithm, which is kind of the main thing that people are concerned about in terms of cryptography. There's no real advantage to it. So factoring with a quantum computer can help break the RSA crypto system, which is kind of very widespread. Typical key lengths that people are talking about for RSA are 1,000 bits or 2,000 bits. There's still a big gap between what people can do on classical computers and that, which is why they like those key lengths. And then a quantum computer needs kind of roughly that many logical qubits, so maybe a few thousand logical qubits to break RSA. But then when you add in error correction and fault tolerance, you have another big overhead. And based on, you know, current algorithms, that might be, say, a factor of 1,000 or something. So that means millions, at least, using existing techniques. Now, there are other crypto systems that are used today, not as widely as RSA, that are presumed to be, based on algorithms people know, more secure than RSA. But unfortunately, that means they use shorter key lengths, and they're equally vulnerable to quantum attacks. So you could probably shave off an order of magnitude, or maybe even two. Probably just one order of magnitude, I would imagine. I don't know. Some people have done this sort of calculation, but I haven't looked at it. If you wanted to attack these other kinds of crypto systems, so if that's your concern, cryptography, you're still at least hundreds of thousands, again using existing error correction techniques.
Do we have like a Moore's law for qubits, or is it just abysmally slow right now?
No. So we're definitely seeing enough advance in the number of qubits to start to plot out an actual exponential growth. It's still kind of early on to see whether this is going to be something that's sustained or not. But and so this is kind of on topic for today and yesterday. So let's try to do that. So Shor's algorithm and kind of the big explosion in quantum computing was in the mid-1990s. So let's start with 1995, when ion traps were kind of first being developed for quantum computing, and there were some optical things. But really, you didn't actually have two-qubit gates in a meaningful sense then. Like the ion trap, they could maybe at that point do a gate between the ion and the phonon, right? They could demonstrate that transition. There were some optical things where you had some kind of phase shift between two separate photons. But let's say there's like one to two qubits there. By 2000, there's a number of systems that had demonstrated real two-qubit things. A few, like NMR quantum computers, which had demonstrated more. I mean, it's a little hard because there's so many different implementations to see how one could plot this. Yeah, I have colors. I could do that. So you might have NMR, which is, you know, starts somewhere in here with a few qubits, and is up to, you know, 5 or even 10 by 2000, but then kind of levels off. And this might be ion traps. There's 1 to 2 and 2005. I mean, I'm just making up numbers. I haven't looked these up, but maybe round 5 here. And yeah, I'm going to run out of space on the board soon. But okay, and so then by 2010, you're seeing ion traps definitely, you know, up to the 10 to 15 level. And I'm not really sure what the status is right now on ion traps. I mean, I think they've been adding more qubits, but mostly they've been trying to get this scaling up between, you know, connecting different sorts of ion traps. And so it's probably somewhere out in the 20-ish range. So you're starting to see this exponential growth there, certainly. And then if you look at superconducting qubits, they started later, more like around 2000. Now in 2017, is up to 20. So that's out here. So we're seeing, you know, something that's more like this. And there's definitely, people are talking about 50 qubits very soon. I mean, it, like, I don't know whether they've, you know, done it and not written it yet, or they're still working on it or what. But that's, you know, putting us up way out of my reach already. So you're definitely seeing in some of these more successful systems an exponential growth. It's really too soon to say how long that could be maintained or what the time scale would be or anything like that. But there's definitely a hope of exponential growth in these systems. Yeah. This is super conductors. Yeah, so the superconductors have pretty much bypass the ion traps, so it's maybe, you know, a little bit faster growth there. Okay, with that, those were the questions.
I had another question.
Another question, yes.
Yeah. So, how come you can get, like, when you shine a laser on a two-level system?
Mm-hmm.
How come you can get just unitary revolution on the two-level system without entanglements?
Ah, right. Yeah, okay, that's a very good question. One I was hoping not to have to go into. But so the laser that you use is in a coherent state. The short version of the answer is the coherent state is kind of a classical state. So we think of it as a classical thing. And in particular, it's an eigenstate of the annihilation operator for a photon. So when you absorb a photon out of a laser in a coherent state, it stays in the same state. Okay. Now, obviously, that can't be exactly true, which is why it's only the short version of the answer, because you're taking energy out of the laser, right? So it can't really be the same state. But in the limit of many, many photons, it's true to a very good approximation. And so that means that absorbing a photon doesn't change the laser state, and therefore it doesn't become entangled with the atom.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just in general, if you have like an interaction between the system and like the laser, if the laser's in an eigenstate of that interaction, you can get unitary evolution.
Right. Yeah, so basically, whenever you're interacting with a laser, unless it's a weak laser, then it's going to be in a coherent state. And coherent state is kind of the natural state for light. Okay, so for laser, any kind of strong laser, that's what you're going to get. If you get you know, state light coming from a star that gets attenuated because it's so very far, far away. It's going to be a weak coherent state. It's just kind of the natural endpoint of any kind of loss process. This is sort of like the central limit theorem always gives you Gaussians. People have made non-coherent states of light, certainly. There's a variety of different things you can do. You can do squeeze states. People now have done all sorts of, you know, entangled states, things like that. But they tend to be very unstable, and they don't survive very well under interaction with the environment. Okay, any other questions? So last time there was a question about what the actual timescales were for decoherence in the ion trap. And so I looked it up. It's actually much longer than I thought. So the time scale for decoherence of just like a single isolated qubit in an ion trap is actually tens of seconds, which is one reason why they're good for clock qubits. But of course, if you're actually building a quantum computer out of this, there's lots of other things that can go wrong. And in particular, heating of the phonon mode is a big problem. And that's the kind of the milliseconds or tens of milliseconds timescale that I mentioned. And of course, the timescale to do gates in an ion trap is microseconds. So that gives you like 10 to the fourth or so operations. It's ballpark. OK. Are there any other questions? OK. So then let's start talking about superconducting qubits. Over maybe. Okay, so superconducting qubits, as you can see from the addition I just made to this chart, are overtaking ion traps as one of the leading candidates. Certainly, they're up there as a big possibility, and people today are talking about, they haven't done it yet, but they're definitely talking about in the very near future doing computations on a superconducting quantum computer that would be extremely expensive. Maybe not impossible, but certainly extremely difficult to do with classical computations. Now, as of yet, those computations would just be things that are totally uninteresting, which is just try to find some problem like doing a random quantum circuit and trying to get the right output distribution. But the point is that they're definitely one of the leading contenders nowadays, and they're actually reaching the point where this is starting to get beyond the capabilities of classical computation. The thing is that there's actually many, many different kinds of superconducting qubits that people have developed over this period since they first started. They started out being kind of very noise prone, and you could only do a small number of gates. But people have improved that through better designs and through better control techniques. And part of the problem with explaining them is that because there are so many different designs, there's like lots of different things you can do. And it's not clear which one is the best to explain, because none of them has really won out in the end. Some have lost out, I should say. A lot of them have been discarded as not really workable for one reason or another. But there's still at least a couple of different competing proposals, and they're constantly developing new ones. So there's no real stability there. But I can at least give you an idea of kind of some of the techniques that get used in this. So one commonality of all of these superconducting circuits is, unlike the ion traps, where you had single atoms or even single electrons, basically, that were your qubits. In superconducting qubits, you have not really macroscopic wires, but at least mesoscopic wires with many, many, many Cooper pairs running in them. Superconducting circuits, remember, are basically some sort of Bose-Einstein condensate of electrons. They pair up, forming bosons, and then they act in a collective fashion. And because they act in this collective fashion, the quantum state of the superconducting condensate tends to be relatively isolated from the environment. So you can actually get effectively, you know, a pure quantum system, even though you have many, many, many Cooper pairs. So that's one clear difference between the superconductors and the ion traps. So the downside of that is the decoherence times will be much shorter. So in some of the systems that I'm telling you about, the decoherence times are more like tens of microseconds. So let me start writing some of this. But one plus side of this is that the gate times are also much shorter because you're using electronics. And so the gate times tend to be of the order of nanoseconds. So again, you have this kind of 10 to the fourth ratio between the decoherence times and the gate times. But I should say that it's taken quite a long time to get the decoherence times to this level. And so I think it's still the case that ion traps, with all the control improvements that they've done, have lower error rates than the superconducting qubits. But that leads us to the other advantage of superconducting qubits, which is that they're solid state systems. And that means that you have a wide variety of manufacturing techniques. You have a lot of, well, you have a lot of options in terms of how you lay down the electronics, which is one reason behind this wide variety of different designs. But the other aspect of that is it's much easier to scale up. You know, once you've gotten a few qubits working and they're connected up together, you just repeat that same thing over and over again. It's not actually that simple. It turns out that, you know, kind of fitting in all of the electronics and control stuff is really a big deal in design of a superconducting circuit, or really actually of any big quantum computer. So it's not actually completely straightforward, but it's a bit easier than ion traps, where you had kind of this limit of one, how big one ion trap could be, and then you have to figure out how to connect them up. And moreover, the manufacturing techniques are kind of, well, they're superconducting manufacturing, so it's not quite the same as what we do in regular computers, but it's maybe more similar to that than what ion traps will need to scale up. Okay, so, right. So how do superconducting qubits work? Well, like I said, there's many different kinds, but they have all kind of similar elements in them. So, so at their heart, they're basically electrical circuits, like you probably did in high school physics. Or I don't know if you took electronics class. But so you have basically three components in these circuits. So one is going to be a capacitor, or multiple capacitors. One is an inductor. Again, there could be multiple inductors. And then the third one is maybe less familiar, which is going to be Josephson junctions, one or more Josephson junctions. One thing, of course, you don't get in these circuits very much is resistors, because they're superconductors, right? There's zero resistance. So, but the inductors and the capacitors and the Josephson junctions, they all have a voltage change associated with them. And so it does all work out. So when we do this with superconductors and we shrink it down to a size, this mesoscopic size, where there's some quantum coherence going on, we'll get a Hamiltonian that's kind of roughly of this form. Sorry. So here the variables are n and phi. N and phi are conjugate variables. Canonically conjugate. So n is the number of Cooper pairs on the capacitor. And phi is the superconducting phase difference. Over the inductor. And so these two things don't commute. Okay. So this is that's what makes this an interesting Hamiltonian. So let's see. So this here is the energy for the capacitor, right? It's basically, you know, Q squared well over capacitance is embedded in this EC. So that's kind of a fairly standard formula taken to the quantum version. I guess this is less obvious, but it's again, you know, a fairly obvious harmonic oscillator thing. If you didn't have this, this would in fact be a harmonic oscillator. Okay? But with the Josephson junction, you get this weird nonlinear inductance. Okay? And this is what makes it a good candidate for doing quantum computation, right? If you just had a harmonic oscillator, you wouldn't really be able to have much in the way of control or to switch things around. But with this nonlinear inductor, you can get all sorts of kind of weird, interesting situations. And you know, frequently there's more than one Cooper Josephson junction here that lets you kind of manipulate things in different ways. So the kind of the early generations of superconducting qubits played around with these things by storing quantum information in various different ways. And by, you know, fiddling with these parameters in the design, you can get kind of different sorts of energy levels for these systems. So for instance, So if you plot this kind of this zero point of the numbers, kind of the default number of Cooper pairs on the capacitor versus energy. So maybe for some typical set of parameters, you might get something that looks like this is the energy levels. So you see that you get some kind of interesting structure here, and then you can tune this by putting charge on and off the capacitor to have different kinds of transitions here. So that was one approach that people used in the earlier days. But one problem with it is that it's very hard to control exactly how many Cooper pairs are on the capacitor, right? And so if the number of Cooper pairs changes a little bit, you get these big changes in energy levels, which means relatively high decoherence rates. So one direction that seems to have pretty much taken over in the past, I don't know, 5 years or so, maybe more, is what's called the transmon design, where we put the capacitance to be something that's very large. And what that does to the energy levels as a function of n sub g is to make them just fairly flat. Okay? And so that has the advantage that it's kind of less vulnerable to charge noise. But it has a disadvantage that you don't have some that kind of ease of control that you had before. And this is kind of a trade-off you see often when people are coming up with implementations, that there's a trade-off between things that are easy to control and things that are well isolated and therefore low decoherence. It's sort of natural, right? Because if you can control it, well, the environment can control it too, right? And so you have to come up with a system where the control that you can do is somehow very different from what the environment is going to do to the system. Anyway, so in the transmon, Well, as a first approximation, what we're going to do is we're going to take two of these energy levels to be our 0 and 1. Okay, and it's hard. I mean, in the early versions of superconducting circuits, it was easy to kind of say exactly what the qubit represented. So, for instance, you could say it's the flux through this circuit. That's the qubit. It has one of two values. Or it could be that would be a flux qubit, or it could be a charge qubit. You could say if there's, you know, zero or, you know, n sub g Cooper pairs on the conductor, that's zero. And if there's n sub g plus one, that's a one. But in these transmon qubits, it becomes some weird superposition of lots of different things. So it becomes a little bit less intuitive, but experimentally superior is the kind of trade-off. Okay? Any questions so far?
What is that diagram, the wavy line is exactly
saying? So this is like the ground state and the first excited state and the second excited state, looking at their energy as a function of n sub g. So remember, this term and this term don't commute.
I see.
So to find the energy levels, you have to, you know, diagonalize this non-commuting Hamiltonian. And again, if it was just this, it would be easy because it would be a harmonic oscillator. But with this nonlinear term, this also doesn't commute with this. I mean, so this type of diagram you'll see a lot in any kind of solid state thing. Frequently, you're actually filling in to get these bands. I don't know if you've seen any solid state physics at all. But in this case, we're, you know, low energies and very quantum, so we're actually just drawing the individual energy levels, but as a function of some parameter that we can control. Any other questions? Okay. Right. So the transmon. So in order, yeah. So like I said, by going to this transmon, you get some resistance decoherence, but at the cost of giving up some of your controllability. And so to get that back, they couple the superconducting circuit to a microwave resonator. So they're basically just putting the superconducting circuit in a microwave cavity. Okay? And it's again has some sort of capacitive coupling, which is effective coupling between the microwaves in the capacitor and the superconducting circuit itself. And the upshot of this is that, again, you know, depending on your parameters and up to some approximations, you get what's called the Jaynes-Cummings Hamiltonian. And the Jaynes-Cummings Hamiltonian describes something that we were discussing yesterday, which is an atom in an optical cavity. So it's a coupling between kind of an atomic system, or in this case, a superconducting system, with a, in particular, two-level system, with a harmonic oscillator mode, in this case, the cavity mode, the microwave field. And so you have three terms. You have the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian for the microwave, and you have some qubit energy Hamiltonian, so a sigma z term. So you have a ground and excited state, and then you have the coupling term between them, which is of the form a dagger sigma minus plus a sigma plus. And so here, sigma plus minus is sigma x plus or minus i sigma y over 2. And so sigma plus minus are raising and lowering operators for the qubits. If you just do this addition, you'll see that sigma plus will take 0 to 1, but not vice versa. And sigma minus will take 1 to 0. Okay, so that's what this term does, is it says we can take 1 to 0 when we add a photon an excitation to the harmonic oscillator. And we can take 0 to 1 when we take a photon or excitation out of the harmonic oscillator. Okay? So in that respect, it's really very similar to this phonon coupling to the atom that we were talking about in the ion trap, that we used to do gates in the ion trap. And so the main difference here, well, there's two differences. So one is the parameters, the typical parameters that you'll encounter here are very different from what you get in the ion trap or other atomic systems. And the other difference is that this coupling is, in the ion trap, we were going to turn on and off that coupling by shining lasers. And here, we're just leaving it on basically all the time. Okay, and we're putting the control elsewhere. So the upshot of having this on all the time is that the qubit is now no longer just the superconducting circuit, even, right? Because you have to diagonalize this Hamiltonian, and so the qubit eigenstates, you know, the ground and excited, 0 and 1, actually are entangled states. Between the superconducting circuit and the cavity. Okay? Any questions on this? Okay, so how do we use this cavity to restore control? Well, there's actually, it's not just the cavity, so there's a couple of things we can do. So one thing we can do is we can drive the cavity with microwaves. And while the system we've chosen to be kind of insensitive to charge noise, depending on how you design it, you can, for instance, have a loop with multiple Josephson junctions. And that lets us couple to magnetic flux, which can be controlled by some other circuit. And so that's another option that you have. You have all sorts of different kind of fabrication options. And so you can also fiddle with the voltages sometimes. And like I said, there's lots of different designs for qubits, even in this kind of transmon regime. And none of them, as far as I can tell, has really won out. So let me just kind of give you a flavor of some of the stuff you can do to create a universal set of gates, but it's not an exhaustive list. Okay, so one option in terms of driving the cavity with microwaves is I think actually fairly standard, which is to do measurement this way. So again, if you put microwaves into the cavity is coupled to the superconducting circuit, so it's going to affect your qubits. And if you put lots and lots and lots of microwaves into the cavity, well, the cavity has to become, the cavity mode has to be basically classical, right? It'll kind of end up in one of those coherent states that we talked about. So, strong microwave. And, but it won't just kind of completely decouple from the qubit. The qubit is still coupled to the cavity. So the actual coherent state that you get in the cavity will depend on the state of the qubit. And because it's a strong coherent state, it's something that's basically classical, that means that it's kind of much easier to pick up and to measure what's going on. Okay? So that's kind of one of your options. So another thing you can do with the microwave cavity is you can put in a weak microwave. And so weak microwave will tend to induce transitions in the field mode, right? You'll go from n to n plus one, for instance. And because of the entanglement, that tends to, through this term, feed back into the superconducting circuit. I should say that mostly we're kind of in the off-resonant regime, I believe, where there's not too much entanglement, but there is still a little bit of entanglement. So adding a weak microwave then kind of induces bit flips. And in particular, you get an effective sigma x Hamiltonian in the qubit. And so this lets you do rotations around one of the axes, right, in the Bloch sphere. Okay? Now, I think anything you're doing with the microwave cavity is going to be fairly slow. So measurement typically is pretty slow in these systems. This is a way to get control. I wasn't able to figure out how they get the sigma x without this, but I'm pretty sure they can't do this usually because it would be too slow, I think, for the decoherence. I mean, like I said, you want to have nanosecond gate times, and anything with a microwave cavity is going to be slower than that. But at least it gives you kind of a flavor of the sorts of options you have. Okay, so but that of course is not enough to get you really very much interest in computation. So what else can you do? So now let's go to some of these other possibilities. So by changing flux in the circuit, so this is, again, you couple to some external system and tune the flux that way. And the flux will then feed back into your superconducting circuit. And if you're changing this term, well, then phi has to compensate for it. And the upshot of that is that your energy levels will change. Okay? So what you're going to do is you change the parameter omega that I had there, which is the energy splitting of the qubits. So one thing you can do with that is you can send qubits in and out of resonance with each other with the cavity by adjusting their energy splitting. Another thing you can do, though, just directly, is do phase gates. Right? Because the 0 and the 1 the 1 is getting a phase, you know, e to the I e, if e is its excitation energy, relative to the 0. E to the minus I e t over h bar. So as time goes on, it's getting a relative phase shift compared to 0. Again, you have to keep track of time so that you can kind of undo that or go into a frame where it's gone. But if you're changing the energy splitting, then that rate of phase change is different. So you're acquiring a relative phase compared to what your kind of default situation was. So for instance, if you do it for one qubit but not for the other qubits, then that one qubit is getting a phase. Okay? And this is basically a sigma z Hamiltonian. And again, that's something that's under your control, whether to insert flux or not. And so if you do it for a certain amount of time, you can get rotations around another axis. And then with the x and the z rotations, of course, you get use the Euler angles again to get arbitrary single qubit gates. Okay? So, right. So, how do we get two qubit gates? Well, again, there's many, many options. So one option is to take your kind of two superconducting circuits and to couple them using just a capacitor. And so it turns out that assuming that these things have the same energy splitting, so we've done this so that both of them are the same. We get the effective Hamiltonian sigma 1 plus sigma 2 minus plus sigma 1 minus sigma 2 plus. So, so what does this do? Well, so this is saying that we can send qubit 1 from 0 to 1 when we send qubit 2 from 1 to 0, or vice versa. So if we have 0, 0, or 1, 1, we can't do anything because we just can't raise one while lowering the other. But 0, 1, and 1, 0 can switch places. Right, so you get some rotation in this two-dimensional subspace. And in particular, if you do it for just the right amount of time, they'll exactly switch. Okay. Now, what does that mean in terms of the qubit states? Well, it means that if the first qubit... So in these two cases... Yeah, sorry, I'm not quite sure how to figure out the logic to explain it. It's easier just to say what the answer is, and then you'll be able to see that it's right. So the answer is that if you do it for the right amount of time, when these just switch, we've swapped the states of the qubit, the logical states of the qubit. Why is that? Well, if you had 0, 0, 1, 1, they were the same to begin with. So swapping them didn't do anything. But in this case, we have really swapped them. Okay? So in either case, we swapped the logical state of the qubit. And so that's what this gate does if run for, you know, half a cycle. Now, of course, that's not a very interesting gate in some sense. I mean, it's useful in some contexts, but we haven't really interacted the qubits, right? We just changed their positions effectively. But it turns out, and this is another one of these surprising things of quantum mechanics, that if you do the square root of the swap gate, if you run this not for a half cycle but for a quarter cycle, so you're getting some superposition between these things, that's an interesting entangling gate. So the square root of swap, if you write down the matrix, is this. So we got so it's gonna all the action is in this middle part, and we get 1 minus I minus I1. And again, you can go through some calculations, and when you combine the square root of swap gate with single qubit gates, arbitrary single qubit gates, you have a universal set of gates. And of course, you can do even better because you don't have to stick to just the square root of swap. You can do some other fractional swap, right? By running this Hamiltonian for some time that's a different fraction. Okay? So that's one approach. I don't think this is the dominant one nowadays, but at least it's fairly simple. Of how you can do two qubit gates in this kinds of system. So let me say a couple of things about the drawbacks of superconducting circuits. So one of them, I guess, I've already alluded to, which is that the decoherence times are shorter. Which is compensated by having a fast gate time, but when occasionally, you know, you get some slow operation like this measurement up here, it starts to kill you. Of course, measurement is slower than gates in a lot of systems. So maybe you have to live with that. So the other thing is the downside of solid state systems in general, which is the ion trap. You know, each qubit was one atom. And the energy difference between the ground and the excited state of the atom is basically always the same. You can adjust it. I mean, there's some fluctuation due to, you know, stray electric fields or magnetic fields. But that's not too bad. Whereas in any kind of solid state system, and in particular superconducting circuits, there's going to be manufacturing differences between every superconducting qubit that you build. They're not all going to be exactly the same, right, to the atom by atom level. And that means that those can cause differences in the, for instance, the energy splitting in qubit 1 versus qubit 2, or its exact response to some of these other couplings that you put in. And so what you have to do when you build one of these circuits is you have to characterize it very carefully to understand exactly what the energy difference is of each qubit and what all these other couplings are. And moreover, that can drift over time as, you know, other kinds of stuff that's going on in the solid state system tends to come in. And so you have to recalibrate periodically. Now, again, ion traps, you're not immune from recalibration. Your lasers also drift over time. You have to recalibrate those. But it's maybe a little bit more resistant to that. Although, again, the time scales are pretty different, so maybe it comes out the same in the end. I don't know. Let's see. So another downside of superconductors, which is not that big a downside in the end, is that superconductors, of course, only work at cryogenic temperatures. And I think, by and large, people are using, like, you know, old school superconductors, not high TC superconductors. So cryogenic really means very, very cold. So you have to put everything in a dilution refrigerator at a few Kelvin or nano, or I don't know what, a micro Kelvin. Very, very cold thing, which creates all sorts of problems. Whereas ion traps, in principle, work at room temperature. And certainly the early generations of ion traps were all done at room temperature. So you need much less overhead to deal with that. Now, as it happens, this business of phonon heating in the ion trap turns out to be much less when you go to colder temperatures. So probably the future of ion traps, and to a certain extent the current day, is also to cool ion traps down to cryogenic temperatures. So in that sense, it doesn't make such a big difference anymore. But it kind of gives you a sense of the different baselines of the technologies. I guess I should say there was a question yesterday about, was it yesterday? I think it was yesterday, about, no, maybe it was earlier this week, about you know, whether in a long, you know, some long period of time, if you buy a computer, will it have a quantum computing capability? And this issue of refrigeration is obviously a big deal, right? Because dilution refrigerators are huge things. You're not going to be able to carry them in your pocket or in your laptop. And so if you need that kind of cryogenic temperature, it seems unlikely that quantum computers will be, you know, a consumer item. But they could still be something that, you know, is in special supercomputing centers and you can log in to run programs on. If you can get around this and do stuff at room temperature, or maybe just, you know, really miniaturize cryogenic stuff, then it becomes more of an option. Okay. Are there questions on superconducting qubits? Yeah.
So one thing that I don't really get is how this circuit constitutes an effective two-level system.
It doesn't really. It doesn't. I mean, that's the point, is that you have many, many, many levels here.
Yeah.
But what you're going to do is you're going to focus on two of those levels. Okay. And the important factor is that this is anharmonic. So the difference between these energy levels is not the same. So that means it is kind of possible to address an individual transition without accidentally exciting to higher energy state. But you will sometimes get those, absolutely. Just like in the ion trap, you know, it's not just a two-level system. There's the grounding inside, but there's lots of other energy levels around. And you will sometimes get them. Now, there are some other systems which are much better two-level systems, but even those, there's always some extra possible states around. Okay? Okay, so in the last 5 minutes, I wanted to kind of very quickly run through some other systems that people have suggested or used to build quantum computers. And I'm not going to say much about them, but just kind of give you the basic idea so that you can see kind of the range of things people have looked at. So one other system is neutral atoms in optical lattices. So the idea there is by shining lasers against each other, you can create a standing wave. And atoms that are, you know, have appropriate level structure to interact with these lasers will tend to sit at nodes So if you do it in one dimension, you just get a standing wave in this direction. But if you do it in two or three directions, you can get like a whole lattice structure of nodes and antinodes. And you can get the atoms to sit at the nodes, or maybe it's the antinodes, I never remember, of this lattice. And you can kind of distribute them evenly. And people have done all sorts of cool stuff with this. And so this is kind of the founding, as I said, of this field of cold atoms. There's just a ton of people working on this. But they're originally proposed as a method for quantum computing. And the idea is you would put the atoms in this lattice, and then by tuning the phase of the lasers, you can shift the kind of the place where the atoms want to sit, depending on the internal state of the atom. Okay? And so by doing that, you can bring the atoms together in a state-dependent way, and then they would interact when they're very close together. Okay? Now, there's all sorts of issues with this, but that's kind of the basic idea of how you do controls in optical lattices. The thing is that it's very hard to kind of individually control atoms this way. People have done it by now, but it's really much easier to just do it something that's uniform for all the atoms in the lattice. And that's why this is kind of split off into a separate field. And one thing that they are interested in these optical lattices is quantum simulations, where you want to simulate a quantum system and you want to do it, you know, some Hamiltonian that is itself of a lattice of atoms. And so what you're doing is you're using this optical lattice system to create a Hamiltonian that's kind of equivalent to the Hamiltonian of the system you want to simulate. And then you look at its behavior. So that's one option that people have looked at. So another one is linear optics. So it turns out a photon is, well, certainly a photon is a very good qubit for communication, right? For instance, if you use the polarization, that's actually a two-level system. It naturally goes from one place to another. It makes it a little hard to do computation because it doesn't stay put. The other problem with computation is that it's hard to get photons to interact with each other. So that's a good thing in terms of their isolation and their lifetimes, but it's a bad thing if you want to do quantum gates. But it turns out that you can take advantage of single photon measurement and the Bose statistics of photons in beam splitters to kind of create some nonlinearity and do gates with that combination of things. So this is another strategy that's certainly advanced over the years. The problem usually is actually getting, you know, the number of photons that you need all at one time. So creating photon sources that, you know, produce a single photon, exactly one photon, exactly when you want them, that's not so easy. And again, people have come up with all sorts of ideas, but that's one reason it hasn't progressed, you know, maybe as fast as some of these other systems. So NMR. So NMR was kind of one of the early leaders. And so there, the qubits are basically the nuclear spins. And you can use, you know, well-established NMR techniques to control them with microwaves. And so there, a single molecule is basically one computer. And the thing is, these NMR things are done in a liquid state in room temperature, usually. And so you don't have just one molecule doing what you want. You have many, many molecules. And they're at room temperature, so they're doing all sorts of things. But by doing some averaging techniques, you can get all of the other random things to cancel out. And the slight advantage of, you know, the ground state versus the excited state means there's a slight excess of those in your system. And with everything else canceled out, you can see the signal of what's going on there. So you kind of have an effective pure state, and you can do quantum computations on that. So the advantages of this is that it used, you know, basically off-the-shelf technology, although to do it to high precision, you needed some improvements to that. And so people were able to scale up to, you know, 5, 10, maybe 15 qubits relatively rapidly. But then all sorts of problems start to crop up with scaling up any higher. So for instance, you're limited by the molecules that you have. And in particular, if you have too many atoms in the molecules, you have it's very hard to distinguish the lines, the energy levels that correspond to the different atoms, the different nuclei, and to address them individually. And so that's something that's pretty much plateaued and is, at least the liquid state room temperature NMR is not going to take over. Yeah. So here's another approach that's more recent, which is if you have a diamond, it's a crystal of carbon. But if you have an impurity in it, a nitrogen in it, well, nitrogen has one less bond potential than carbon. And so the nitrogen will get a next to it, usually, or somewhere there has to be, but usually next to it, is there going to be a vacancy in the carbon lattice. And the combination of these turns out to have spin 1/2. And it, so it's like a qubit. And diamond, it turns out, is a very pure substance. And therefore, these effective qubits are very well isolated. And they have incredibly long lifetimes. Decoherence times in these NV centers are like minutes in some cases. So this, I think, is the kind of the system in which you have the longest recorded decoherence times. Now, the problem with that is, again, it's very well isolated, and so it's hard to control. You can control individual NV centers by, illuminating them with the appropriate frequency of light. But getting them to talk to each other, that's pretty difficult. I think probably some progress has been made on that, but not a ton. Instead, these NV centers have now become kind of a leading candidate for quantum sensors that use quantum information ideas to improve metrology and sensing of other systems. And then two more quickly solid state systems that have not progressed as much, which is spins in silicon and quantum dots. So spins in silicon is kind of a hybrid of silicon-based stuff and NMR. So you have electrodes with single atoms embedded in them. And you do NMR on the individual atoms. But you can then couple these atoms using regular electronics. So something that seemed very promising, but it's kind of not progressed so fast. Quantum dots are, again, a silicon-based thing. You can make like a little well of silicon that can basically trap individual electrons. It's sometimes called an artificial atom. And you'll have some nice energy levels that can serve as your qubit. And you can couple them together with appropriate manufacturing techniques. Again, these things have not progressed as far. The one hope was that taking advantage of silicon, we have huge industry devoted to manufacturing things in silicon. But it hasn't really panned out in terms of control and decoherence times, as far as certainly not as well as the superconductors, for instance. OK. So that's kind of an overview of other things that people are working on in terms of implementations. So I guess you have a tutorial this afternoon. And then next week, we'll come back, and we're going to go to a different subject, very different. We're going to be talking about algorithms and complexity.